We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Welcome into the RotoWire NFL podcast. I am your host, John McKechnie, joined, as always, by Mario Puig. This edition of the RotoWire NFL podcast, as always, sponsored by our friends over at WinBet. Mario, how are you on this fine Thursday?
I'm fine. It's getting rainy, and so in my room I'm recording from looks darker, even darker than usual. I just want to make it known, like, I'm not voluntarily just sitting in the dark like you may have seen previously. Like, I really tried this time. There's just nothing to do.
Yeah, you know, the take bunker, it exists for a reason, and it can be affected by the conditions and forces of nature.
1 hour a week I have this light on, and it's on, and it's, you know, it's just all we have in these facilities.
Fair enough. I'm at the RotoWire HQ, and I got the ring light going and the overhead fluorescence. So I'm looking extra oily today, I think. Nice. Just it's a proper
it's a
shine.
Of the year to look oily.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, man. With the gas shortage and everything. Anywho. Let's talk some football. We got a lot to get to today. We're going to get into your most recent article, taking stock of some best ball trends. Specifically, we're going to be talking about Josh Jacobs and how he fits into the draft configuration, the draft picture. That'll be an interesting one. Also going to keep our series of deep dives going. Today we're going to go up north a little bit. We're going to hit the Lions and the Vikings, break down their offenses from a fantasy perspective. The Lions one I'm particularly interested in because there's just so much unknown with that entire skill group. So, you know, there could be kind of diamonds in the rough late in drafts that we could find and unearth. We're also going to talk a little bit about Javonte Williams. It's been 3 weeks since we talked about him or something, so we got to bring him back. Got to bring him back into the discourse. But Mario, let's lead things off talking Josh Jacobs. So I think it's fair to say that neither of us have always been like the pound the table guys for Josh Jacobs in the past. You know, whether it was him as a draft prospect during his time at Alabama or through his first two seasons of his NFL career. But he's been, of course, a productive, useful fantasy player, even if, like, the efficiency and all that isn't always the best. But it feels like the market, as you note in your article, has really cooled on him, and a lot of it may have to do with the signing of Kenyon Drake this offseason, you know, maybe coming for some of those snaps. But what's kind of the latest read from you as far as Jacobs and why he's going as late as he is, and does that make him someone to consider at ADP?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we were not just kind of we were more hostile, I think, than we were indifferent, and certainly, you know, partial toward Jacobs. Like, we were kind of like, man, why the hell are they talking about him like a first round pick? He wasn't even better than Damian Harris. And even now, I don't think he's better than Damian Harris. I think Damian Harris is better. But we don't particularly at this new price need Jacobs to be especially good. We just need him to be the guy who gets a certain number of carries in the Raiders offense. And as long as Derek Carr stays healthy, as long as John Gruden keeps that offense well sequenced with its play calling and everything. I think they're still going to, move the chains and stuff. Probably not going to be one of the highest scoring offenses, but they shouldn't be bad. And if you have a running back who's approaching 20 carries a game and an offense that isn't terrible, then they probably shouldn't be falling into the mid fifth round, which is, these might've been extreme cases, like unusual anecdotes, but I did a couple underdog mega tournament or whatever it's called, drafts. And he seems to be falling pretty regularly to the late fourth at this point, and will often fall a little bit into the fifth. And in one case, I got him a couple picks after Mike Davis, which feels very wrong to me. Like, true, Kenyon Drake is not the backup you really want to see behind a guy that you're drafting at running back, and you don't want to see a team spend whatever it was, however many, $10 million or whatever, guaranteed on the backup like that with Drake in Jacobs's case. But there's just enough room in that offense for Jacobs to kind of get to a point, especially with a fifth round standard rather than like the high second or late first like he was last year. Mm-hmm. I feel like right now he's even going like a round or two later than he was his rookie year, which so me and you, John, were probably low on him during those two eras of that high price. And now that he's falling into the fifth, it kind of David Montgomery last year, like we were not high on him at all as a prospect, especially in his rookie year. We weren't paying the price. And then we start doing some drafts last year, and not because we sat around thinking, wow, David Montgomery's so good, maybe we were wrong about him. Like, that's not what it was, but we got to the drafts and it was like, hey, I think I want to kind of pick a David Montgomery, maybe a bunch, because he's so much cheaper than before and everyone hates him now. And it's like people make these expectations that are unreasonable in the first place, hold it against the players rather than themselves, and kind of let it bleed into their projections for the next year. And I think that's pretty much happening with Jacobs right now. Like, he at this new price anyway, he's just not that risky, because the upside is basically not being acknowledged, and the floor is presupposed as lower than it actually is. Like, it's just when he's going later than a guy like Davis, especially, who I know he's locked in for, or he's projected for a pretty nice role right now, certainly with the Falcons. But even as a Jacobs skeptic, I would say Davis is not particularly close to him as a talent. And B, there's definitely running backs in the NFL who, maybe not like a Leonard Fournette case exactly, but guys who are just vaguely good who get cut or put up available for trade could end up on the Falcons and just make Davis like a ninth round pick overnight, you know? So taking him over a guy like Jacobs, who is definitely going to be in the offense, like maybe someone like me is too optimistic about how much of the offense with Jacobs, but there will be some amount guaranteed, and it's definitely higher than whatever floor you have in mind with Mike Davis. So I just think that Kenyon Drake is not there to like take the job. It's because Gruden just thinks having backup running backs is cool.
So I guess explain the path to which Jacobs, you know, is able to maintain that, or, you know, we're talking about a moving target. You know, we're not expecting him to return first round value like we were a year ago, or what his ADP presupposed. We're talking again, you know, fourth, early fifth, that type of thing. But still, you know, assuage the concerns about the Kenyon Drake potential timeshare. Like, what does the path stay on when it comes to Jacobs to where he can return value at ADP?
Well, I don't know what exactly the yardage count we'd need, what touchdown count we'd need for him to be useful in the late fifth. I guess, admittedly, some of my reasoning is just kind of looking at what's going earlier than him and simply not seeing the basis for projecting those players higher, and especially not higher than they actually go. But basically, when you look at Jacobs and the way that this Raiders offense shapes up, the way even with Kenyon Drake around that it shapes up, I think it's pretty easy to see a scenario where Jacobs gets to over 250 carries, health permitting, especially with the 17th game added. I think it would have been the case for 16 games, but for 17 games, definitely. And you don't need to be aggressive with the snap count that you project to get to that number. He can just stop. You can put like a ceiling of 600 snaps on your Josh Jacobs projection this year. And I think that number that you get, if you vaguely keep up with his previous per snap carry and target rates, like, he'll easily clear it. And maybe there's more upside to consider there too. But for me, even as a Jacobs skeptic who's not really thinking about the upside possibility, the floor, I think, is being under-acknowledged, because you look at Devontae Booker and Jalen Richard last year in that offense with Jacobs missing a game. So with that missed game, you can kind of make that similar to, you know, if you want to project a decrease in his usage rate because of Drake being there, it's like, fine, you can look at last year's offense over 15 games, and there's still something like 400 snaps available for Drake, something where he could get up to 115 carries and 40 targets, as long as he's taking Jalen Richard's usage too. And Jalen Richard is a cut candidate. He's not on the hook for much money. If they want to justify Kenyon Drake by taking Richard out of the offense, they can easily do it. And even if he also takes a little bit from Jacobs, it's still, again, something where you get to like 250 carries and it's not that hard. So I can understand being concerned about Jacobs' durability, like the shoulder his rookie year and then last year the ankle. He also played like through a hip injury or something like that last year. But it's I think more for that reason that John Gruden wanted to go get Kenyon Drake. Was because it's just like he likes to run the offense through the running back. And if the running back breaks, he doesn't like to rebuild the offense because all that he has left is Jalen Richard. So he has Drake there for like expensive, albeit, but insurance. And I think he's also rationalizing it, but he'll give us better reps than Richard too. So it's worth the money. So and he could very well be right. I think it's a pretty crazy amount of money they gave Drake, especially in the second year. He's going to cost like $8 million against the cap next year. But I think that's just because Gruden's a guy of like the late 90s, early 2000s, and teams liked to have really good backup running backs back then. And he doesn't probably understand the cap at all. So trying to make it like, oh, do you think John Gruden would pay the 22nd highest running back salary for a guy just to be a backup? Yeah, I do. I think he could do things much dumber than that, too. I think he could, for instance, draft Damon Arnett in the first round of an NFL draft and then maybe cut him the next year. So it's... To assume that John Gruden, of all people, is going to be on the cutting edge of efficiency and like a responsible spending is just to not know who that guy is.
All I'm saying, bring back Charlie Garner and Tyrone Wheatley.
Yeah, that would be pretty cool. I guess we don't have the Charlie Garner part here. If he wanted to do that, he's going to find out Drake's the Wheatley and Jacobs is the actually good one.
There we go. Oh, man. Those are some fun Raiders
Wheatley
teams.
It
Gruden 1.0. That.
Charlie Garner was awesome.
The aesthetics on Wheatley, though, were so strong.
That's just true.
Like,
giant
like
47.
Him just like running dudes over on the baseball diamond at the Oakland Coliseum. It doesn't get much better than that.
Huge guy.
Yes, absolutely massive. Looking elsewhere, or staying here, actually. So we've talked about how Jacobs and Drake can kind of coexist in this offense and how Jacobs, you project him for 600 or so snaps, you know, and is that like if that's a conservative or just kind of realistic projection for
his last year? Yeah, last year he ran 616 snaps in 15 games. So even if you project him losing snaps to Drake, he gets to 600 certainly in 16 games, certainly in 17 if you know, his luck cooperates with his durability. So, yeah, I don't feel like I'm being aggressive when I'm projecting this kind of, like, I don't know what you would say. I guess, like, I would say median range is, like, 1,100 rushing yards and a good chance at 8-plus touchdowns because other than maybe Bryan Edwards and of course, Darren Waller, they don't have an obvious way to score touchdowns if they get into scoring range. And Derek Carr can at least move the chains, get you into scoring range. Like he's never been terrible at that. It's more kind of like the touchdowns and the big plays when you really need them kind of thing. So we don't need at this price for Jacobs to be like a heroic player. We just need him to be better, more productive than Mike Davis. And I don't know, I wouldn't be surprised if not to go to the Javonte part too soon, but I wouldn't be surprised if in the next 10 days or so you start to see Javonte Williams go ahead of Josh Jacobs. That maybe I'm just being paranoid and that'll never happen and I'm making up a guy to get mad at right now, but we'll see.
Well, that's always fun to do anyway. And to your point about, you know, the touchdown upside and you know the usage, looks like according to our handy dandy red zone stats here on RotoWire on Josh Jacobs' player page, he had 68 red zone touches last year. So that's a pretty good amount. So you converted a lot of them into touchdowns. He had 12 rushing scores last season, of course. So we can definitely envision him getting the work down when the Raiders get there. And like you said, the Raiders, even if it's not sexy, and even if Derek Carr is not like our favorite guy in the world, like you still have to respect that they can move the ball on people. They did it last year, and they're going to do it again. So rounding it out, in regards to Drake and where he's going, do you think that he might actually be a value as well, given that, you know, Jacobs is going to soak up those 600 or so snaps? Maybe Drake can push for those 400 or so and you know, have those be, you know, a high touch per snap type of role.
Yeah, I think that it's not just Jacobs, it's Drake also, who's kind of getting penalized for being a fantasy disappointment last year. And Drake was he ended up those 10 touchdowns and 900 yards or whatever, but people were taking ahead of like Nick Chubb and maybe even Aaron Jones, guys like that. So it was a pretty disastrous pick. If you had Kenyon Drake last year, your team probably lost and you probably don't like him. And so if you're in drafts now, you're basically not looking at him. And I feel like sometimes I see him fall into the 11th round, and I'm not going to say he needs to go sooner than that, but I think he's definitely a reasonable pick in that range. And I think also it's worth thinking about his how he fits into that general category of running backs who are backups, who we imagine as high upside in the event that the starter gets injured. Because you see a pretty inconsistent standard, I think, across the pricing of guys like him, Tony Pollard, Alex Mattison. Like, Tony Pollard's still going at that maximum price in that group, but I don't know that there's an objectively different projection for him than for like Drake or Madison, or even a guy like Devontae Booker behind Saquon Barkley. So I think there are some of those handcuff running backs that people pay too much for, and I don't think Drake is one of them, even though it's not like I think he's a, you know, obvious mega buy right now or anything like that.
So taking a look at ADP from the NFFC dating back to the beginning of this month, I'll give you a toss up between these three. So Drake, Zach Moss, and Damian Harris kind of going in that same cluster in like the ninth or so round.
Yeah, that one's I guess the PPR scoring there might make it a little different, especially as it goes with you know, Damien Harris, because I don't know if we expect him to catch 10 passes this year. An underdog, the half-point PPR makes it a little easier, I think, to rationalize Harris. And I love Harris as a talent, but so yeah, I would probably go Harris, but that might be me being a little too confident in my like prospect evaluation of him. I will say that I do think Zach Moss is a really good three-down player. If he's, for some reason, gets the usage, I'm confident he will outplay Devin Singletary. I'm just kind of concerned that the Buffalo offense would basically need Josh Allen to get hurt for Moss to get the rushing workload, especially that he would need to break out. But Drake, I would probably, yeah, leave in even third there. But it's not because I feel that confident about it. It's just that I think he's a little bit further away from the field, certainly a lot further away from the field than Harris is. I would think Harris is the pretty clear starter there.
Right. Okay. So that makes sense. Distilling it down like that, boy, a lot of Alabama running back discussion to open things up. So there's that.
Eddie Lacy should still be in the league too. Just had to had to eat his way out of the whole league, and it's a bummer because he was like the best one. He was the best ever, man.
Dude, he broke my heart in 2012. I'm okay with him being out of sight, out of mind. But no, but he was a fun player though. I'll give you that. Let's see. Before we move on to Javonte Williams, quick word from our sponsors.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
All right, let's pick it back up. Going over to Javonte Williams. So obviously the rookie out of North Carolina. He's had very loud proponents throughout the draft season. And then, you know, the landing spot, pretty fortuitous. I think we could agree that going into the draft, there were only a handful of teams that you felt like were prime candidates to take it an early round running back. Denver kind of was among them, even though they have Melvin Gordon under contract, of course. But either way, you know, the buzz is only going to continue to grow when it comes to Williams. And do you think that that's sending his current ADP a little bit too high? And are people writing off Melvin Gordon too soon?
We'll see where it goes. I think if Williams stays in that kind of seventh round sort of range, then he makes enough sense, especially if you're a team that went cheap at running back in the early rounds and you're at the point in the draft where you're like, I need to take somebody or I'm not going to get anybody, and Javonte is the highest one on the board. If you're in that situation, I get it. But, man, seeing that guy, I'm just rattled by that one person in that draft taking Mike Davis ahead of Josh Jacobs, because now it's like when people start working themselves up about theories of like three down upside and, you know, workhorse upside, they start just making a lot of leaps of faith that they probably shouldn't. And I don't want to say that I think lowly of Williams or anything like that. I feel like I am pretty consistently clear that I think he's pretty good. You know, like I think he's a player who projects as a totally decent, viable starting prospect eventually, at least, maybe not right away, but eventually. I don't think he in any particular respect looks like a star prospect, but I don't think he needs to be one. I think he can be kind of in that like Miles Sanders. Like, I think he's better than David Montgomery. I don't think he's as good as like Cam Akers last year. So I think he's about as good as Zach Moss. And I think that a player like him could be quite good if a certain opportunity came about and if you could get him at a certain price before that. But what we're seeing right now is a kind of like, not just the assumption of Gordon leaving, which maybe that could happen. I have no idea. They're not like bound to him cap wise, but I don't know. Maybe they keep him, maybe they don't. Let's just say they don't. Even if they don't keep Melvin Gordon, there's still Royce Freeman on that roster and Mike Boone, who they apparently like. I kind of missed that in the offseason when they went and signed him, and immediately Vic Fangio took to the press to be like, we love Mike Boone. So that might be kind of like not the same sort of player, but a similar out of nowhere prominence, kind of like J.D. McKissic last year. Like Scott Turner went and signed him right away in free agency. It was like, why would they do that? Who cares? It's J.D. McKissic. And it just, for whatever reason, turned out they wanted to use him a lot. And Boone could be that kind of thing. I don't really know. I don't know either way. But he and Royce Freeman are both more athletic than Javonte Williams. And especially Royce Freeman was a more productive player in college by miles. So we have a guy like Royce Freeman who's bigger, faster, quicker, more productive in college than Javonte Williams. Freeman has, yes, been disappointing in the NFL. But it's still a little bit early. Like, you don't want to write him off forever. There's a chance he just kind of had like three disappointing years for no good reason. He could break out, especially if he's on a different team. But B, that kind of case like Royce Freeman is one that should make you reconsider why we're so sure that Javonte Williams is going to be a great NFL player. Because I'm not saying that he has worse odds than Freeman at this point. Like, Freeman's already given us reason to doubt him as an NFL player, and Williams hasn't. But if a guy is as fast and big and quick and productive as Freeman can still disappoint, then why are we sure that a guy who was worse in every metric would definitely be better, especially right away? And Mike Boone, he's more athletic too. He fell apart like his last year at Cincinnati, but before he was hurt in that last year at Cincinnati, he was very productive there. So I'm just saying those two can do stuff. They're not useless, and they're definitely not bad athletes. They are definitely better athletes than Williams. So if Williams is going to be a better player, he's going to have to find a way to be a better player despite having an athletic disadvantage. And that's totally possible. He really might have just kind of like the vision, killer instinct, motor, stuff like that, balance to be better than them, even though they're faster and bigger than him. But he needs that, and not many people seem to look at it that way. They seem to think he is the best athlete of the three, and he isn't.
And I think there's also the element of a lot of what kind of drove his proponents during the pre-draft process was, you know, his ability to break tackles and his physicality. And then, you know, he checks in and he's not actually like built like an NFL power running back. So like that, you know, right. That stylistic like issue. Right. So he's not built like Nick.
And he's not as
like
fast.
No. Yeah. So like those are two potential things that I think were either just kind of like overlooked or one way or the other. I mean, you were right on it when, you know, during the North Carolina Pro Day where it's like, oh, that is not an ideal way in for him. And you know, I tend to agree because we did just see this 2 years ago with David Montgomery where, yes, he had all those broken tackles in college. But like that was because he wasn't getting away from people. And then, you know, that broken tackle rate is going to come way down once you get to the NFL and you get more sure tacklers around you and faster, bigger athletes and everything. So you're not gonna be able to break those tackles the same way. So Javonte will kind of need to find a way to make it work one way or the other. And you know, the tools are you know, good, like starter level, but maybe not quite what people are envisioning, especially with where as high as they might take him.
Yeah, and John, don't you think it's strange that no one was hyping Javonte Williams as a prospect, not even as like a mid-round kind of guy? Like no one was hyping him before the 2020 season. And it's not that we never saw him. He was hanging around, but what do you know? He's right at about 5 yards a carry his first year. He's at 5.6 yards per carry with only 5 touchdowns on 166 carries his second year. Then in 2020, you know, with one of the best downfield passing games in the nation, keeping the safeties back and keep concerned about the quarterback run threat as well, both Williams and Michael Carter both see their numbers skyrocket. And I think it is possible that both Williams and Carter are both very good and like clear starters, maybe even above average starters in the NFL. But they kind of do both need to be for either of them to be, including Williams. Like how is Williams seeing his production perfectly correlate to Michael Carter's unless they're of a similar quality of player? There's no basis to project them divergently on the basis of tools. Javonte Williams is not more toolsy than Michael Carter, even though Michael Carter's, you know, probably a little bit below average tools-wise. Javonte Williams is below average tools-wise for his weight. So it's not great. It's one of those things like, you know, you have Kareem Hunt. He ran the 4.62 or whatever it was, and he's plenty explosive in the NFL. But he also ran that at 220 or something like that. He wasn't 212. He ran it at a combine too. It wasn't at a pro day track. So there's these kinds of just exceptions that people make, these just leaps of faith that they keep making for Javonte Williams. And at the very least, if you get yourself hyped up for a player because you think they're Nick Chubb and then they turn out to not be at all like that, I want to see a revised narrative, you know, and I've never seen the attempt. They just said like, oh, well, he's still Chubb. I can just say, hey, 40 times aren't always real, you know. This guy didn't run a great 40, and look at him. It's like, yeah, well, that guy wasn't 15 pounds lighter either. So you're being very arbitrary about this. And if someone was, if the market for Javonte existed as it currently does, and people instead said things like, yeah, I think he could be like a little bit slower, but a much tougher Miles Sanders, I would be like, hey, that's fair. If that's what you think of him and that's how you got to this valuation, I guess you're not being crazy when you say that. But if you say he's worth this much, he's worth X because he is Chubb and he is not Chubb, then he's not worth X. Somebody's just wrong here. And I don't think it's me.
I don't think so either, man. So I think you have that dialed right up. Let's go ahead, jump on over to the Lions. Let's go ahead and dive in on those Detroit Lions. Very, very new look group that they have. Obviously, one of the biggest splashes of the entire offseason. going ahead and making that trade, getting rid of Matthew Stafford, bringing in Jared Goff. So that immediately gives them a pretty significant downgrade at quarterback. Obviously, a new coaching staff in tow. Kenny Golladay is gone. So, you know, it's this group of receivers at the top where you got Tyrell Williams, you know, trying to, you know, latch on. Breshad Perriman, same deal. Quintez Cephas, I think he can stick. And then, of course, they spent a draft pick on Amon-Ra St. Brown. So what is your vision of how this offense is going to look? You know, what are the components? Who's the offensive coordinator? And, you know, what kind of stylistic things are they going to bring to the table that was different from last year in Detroit?
So it's Anthony Lynn is technically the offensive coordinator, but I think it's not so much that he has a scheme that he was hired to implement as much as Dan Campbell, the head coach, previously the tight ends coach, I want to say, for the Saints under Sean Payton for something like six yep. years. He was like the interim for like five games for the Dolphins a while ago. He's the head coach, and I think he's the guy who more or less has the vision here. And I'm guessing Dan Campbell, like, I know people want to just kind of box him in as like a run-obsessed caveman throwback coach. I think he's more like a futuristic caveman, and I think he's
the caveman that picked up the tool.
Yeah, you'll still see him like eating roadkill or something, but he's also got a calculator on him, and he's not afraid to check it out once in a while, like when he needs to figure out what to tip or whatever. And he's going to be willing to look at things from I think a variety of perspectives that people aren't really accustomed to seeing from coaches. I think like we're accustomed to either seeing the Jeff Fisher, Pete Carroll, or the Sean McVay. And I think Campbell might be kind of in between those kinds of things. Like he's basically trying to be the modern Bill Parcells. Him and Aaron Glenn, the defensive coordinator, like you can see they're both Parcells disciples. And I think Parcells was a pretty pragmatic coach back at the time. I mean, like Drew Bledsoe led the league in pass attempts probably 3 years in a row. From like 94 to 97 or 95 to 97, something like that. And Parcells was the head coach. So if a guy is hard-nosed and, you know, Jersey tough as Parcells, that kind of cliche of a guy can still throw a lot because his ideology is pragmatic like that, then I think Campbell could be that too. So I think he's going to have the final say more than Lynn. I think it's more like he just knows Lynn. And actually, I don't know. This might have been after Parcells retired, but Lynn was with the Cowboys as a running backs coach 2005, 2006. I don't know where Campbell was at the time, but it's possible that they linked up just because they know each other, basically, and not because Lynn's going to run it or design it, but because him and Campbell know how to communicate and work with each other, and it's something more like that, in my opinion. But if you look at the personnel of the offense, I think you can start to see hints of what they plan to do. If you try to just base it on like what he said, what Campbell says, or what Anthony Lynn did in the past, I think you might get a little off track. But basically, we have DeAndre Swift in the backfield. We have TJ Hawkinson at tight end. And you have two slower, smaller receivers, not small truly, but not big. Quintez Cephas and Amon-Ra St. Brown, guys who have been productive as pass catchers but don't really have any speed. And then you have Breshad Perriman and Tyrell Williams, who I think Williams especially has a little bit more to offer than fly routes and post routes, but they are generally there, I think, to run fly routes and post routes. They're both fast sideline guys. And if a defense doesn't send their safety after them, you can just chuck it up there. You know, maybe they catch it. Maybe they got a defensive pass interference. But even just making that one threatening throw, you probably get a different look from the safety the second time you run that play. So having those guys out there, I think, invites like decoy usage pretty clearly on their part, especially when you consider that Goff isn't really a great downfield thrower. So you don't need Goff to be able to throw to them downfield for them to have a utility in pulling the safeties back, but they only have a utility in that case if you're getting the Hawkinson and Swift open in the middle of the field, and I guess to a lesser extent Cephas and St. Brown, depending on how their competition works out. I don't know if they intend to go one particular direction, you know, decisively, or if they're willing to let it like competition and training camp play out their plan for them. I guess I could imagine a scenario where Cephas or Sound are productive. Probably only one of the two, though. I think they're fighting over the same, not even really like a pie. It's kind of like a half of a pasty. And they're fighting over that. And there's otherwise probably some favoritism institutionally towards Swift and Hockenson, but it makes sense because they would be running in the slot a lot. They would be running in the middle of the field, the intermediate part of the field. And if a safety is going after Perriman, if a safety is going after Tyrell Williams, that's a tough pair of guys to stop if one of them is being covered by a linebacker, especially. So I think that could make sense. I think you could see Campbell drawing on some of the things that he learned watching Sean Payton with the Saints, getting Michael Thomas schemed open, getting Alvin Kamara schemed open. And I think it's pretty clear they plan to use Swift basically how the Saints use Kamara, basically how the Chargers use Austin Eckler. And I think if that's true, then Swift is pretty easily justified as a second round pick in PPR scoring and certainly a third rounder in half point PPR. I think that Hockenson is, it's a tough one. Like, I don't have a lot of shares, but it's not because I look at his price and say that's, you know, that's wrong or anything. I think he's really good. He was a little tiny bit below baseline last year, but he was coming back from that nasty ankle issue too. So maybe he's going to be a little healthier this year. Maybe he was going to take a third year jump anyway. So I do like Hockenson too. I think you got to expect those two to lead the team in receptions.
Okay. So Hockenson and Swift are both, yeah, like going to be the kind of engines of that offense. So if you were to, you know, try to find some late round value, you know, like usually, you know, once you get past like the 15th, 16th round, something like that, you start throwing some darts. Who is the dart in this particular offense? Is it St. Brown or is it Cephas, one of the deep threat guys?
It's tough, man, because I think Cephas and St. Brown are both good prospects, and like they are both eventually anyway going to be starter viable, at least from the slot. It'll be interesting to watch how that shakes out though, because Cephas is of course not very, even the 4.7 time at the combine, if you make it more like a 4.58 of the Wisconsin track, that's basically the same time. So he's really like a 4.65 kind of guy. Sometimes the 40 time doesn't translate perfectly to functional wide receiver task speed, and maybe Cephas is a guy who, even if he's the slowest receiver on the field, maybe he runs this kind of route faster than the middle range kind of guy. Like maybe he's just functionally, he makes up for it somehow, because production wise, it's always been there. At Wisconsin, it was always there. Last year, it was only in flashes last year, but he was running outside for the most part last year. So the fact that he kept up at all as a rookie, I think is pretty encouraging. And you would think that if he is poorly projected outside because of the speed, then moving him into the slot should be a way to make him viable again. So the only problem is him and St. Brown cannot compete with Williams or Breshad Perriman for downfield tasks. Like they're just not really eligible for it. So they have to do a lot of winning underneath and in the intermediate. And I think they have to totally shut out the other one, you know? So maybe that scenario doesn't hold because maybe Perriman or Williams gets hurt, or maybe Cephas or St. Brown gets hurt, and maybe then the three that are left add up, obviously enough. But in the meantime, I feel like they just, especially with Swift and Hockenson, if you assume that they're going to take as big of a share as I do anyway, then it's hard to see how there's room for more than maybe two actual target kind of options. And so I don't know. It's hard for me to, unless injuries hit, it's hard for me to imagine Perriman, Williams, St. Brown, Cephas thinning out enough for that remaining pie to be especially useful. But if you do get an injury to St. Brown or Cephas, I definitely like the remainder to be the clearly best slot receiver on the team, because they're both good. They can run routes. They can catch the ball. They know how to play receiver. They just aren't fast or big.
Right. And, you know, if that situation occurs where one of them clearly is in the driver's seat for one reason or another, do you think that just the fact that so much of the pie is already going towards those short and intermediate routes to Swift and Hockenson, that maybe like that slot role at receiver just isn't going to be as prominent because they're already going to have so much kind of traffic in there?
Right. I would expect the Lions to log among the lower wide receiver rep counts this year in the league, and even though they don't project to have many leads at all, if any, because so many of those routes, if you assume a three wide base, you're going to have some plays where I don't know who their other tight ends are, but you're going to have some where it's like Hockenson is the slot receiver, and there's a second tight end playing inline tight end. You're going to have some three wide looks where Hockenson is the inline tight end, but Swift is the slot receiver, and Jamal Williams is playing actual running back. So the number of slot receiver snaps available on the team might not be very high. It might be among the lowest in the league. So there's a lot working against the Cephas and St. Brown. I think you usually see their prices pretty close to free. So I won't say there's a ton of risk with them as long as you're limiting your exposure. But if you assume any particular floor there, I think you might be getting ahead of yourself.
Okay. All right. That definitely checks out. Anything else to add on to the Lions before we move on over to the Vikings?
Yeah, Jamal Williams may be a human shield running back. He may be like a short yardage guy they give carries to when they don't want Swift to get hurt. Some of those may even occur in the red zone. I think he's proven that he's one of the least effective players from scrimmage, though. I think in function, he will be a mascot more than anything else. And I think you got to, if you do invest in Jamal Williams, don't go over a certain exposure count with that one either, because if Jamar Jefferson is DeAndre Swift's actual backup come week six, I don't think anyone should be surprised at all by that.
Wow. Okay. All right. Putting the hammer down when it comes to Jamal Williams. All right, let's move on over to the Vikings. A lot of the same pieces left over from a year ago, so that not a ton of imagining necessary to project this Vikings offense. You got Cousins, you got Dalvin Cook coming off of the career year, Justin Jefferson already established as a bona fide star, Adam Thielen maybe on the other side of his peak, but still an effective player nonetheless when he's healthy. What the big kind of thing that people might be inclined to chase in this offense, because everything else is so firmed up, I think tends to be who's that number three receiver. And now with Kyle Rudolph out of the picture, who's the tight end, to target in this Minnesota offense. So start things off, looking at that, wide receiver three in Minnesota.
Yeah. So it might be a bit of a committee kind of thing for that third receiver spot. Hopefully Chad Beebe gets subtracted entirely from the offense. He's just, it's obscene. It's actually like wrong to have him playing NFL wide receiver. It's like if you want to make him a gunner or a punt protector or something like that, fine, but don't have him playing receiver. That's ridiculous. It's not fair to other receivers in the league. They deserve that rep more. I think that the days of seeing Chad Beebe going nowhere are finally past us, though. Irv Smith has been playing a lot of slot receiver the last 2 years. That's probably going to continue this year. The answer to the question of whether it's more than in the past might depend on a competition and training camp. I don't know. It's possible Mike Zimmer kind of in Kubiak, whichever point in the dynasty we're at, whichever one, if they have a set opinion by now of Irv Smith, maybe they just know like he's only playing 30 snaps a game, 40 snaps a game. Maybe they don't believe that. Maybe they're waiting to see how he looks in training camp before deciding. It's hard in any case to see Irv Smith becoming the breakout player that was briefly hoped for when Rudolph's release occurred, unless he takes the inline snaps that used to go, or a lot of the inline snaps, I should say, that used to go to Rudolph. That might be possible, but he's so differently built than Rudolph. Yeah. It's like you're talking like 3 inches shorter and probably like a good 25 pounds lighter. And if he can play inline, great, but it's not often that you find a Jonnu Smith kind of guy who's 250 or less and can still maul in the run game. And Irv does not seem like one of them. So
no.
Maybe they let him get some of those snaps, but if they don't, Tyler Conklin's kind of just going to be the same as Rudolph, just probably not quite as good. And I wasn't excited about Rudolph in the first place, so I don't really care about Conklin, but in two tight end leagues or leagues that give a lot of points for tight end receptions, I guess he should be like a pretty reasonable breakout candidate, because he's, you know, going from nobody to somebody who might catch like 40 passes or something like that.
Okay, so we're assuming potentially that Conklin absorbs that Rudolph role, because like you said, Irv Smith just doesn't really project out to be like the inline blocker type of setup. Right. So Irv Smith, so the way that they distribute the targets in this offense is interesting, because so much of it is absorbed by by two guys, by Jefferson and by Thielen. They accounted for just under 50% of the targets a year ago, and on average it would have been over 50 had Thielen not missed a little bit of time. Dalvin Cook drew 11% of the targets as well. So, I mean, that's a lot. And then, like you said, they might just kind of go committee approach the rest of the way because no one else was over 10% of the target share. Irv Smith was the next guy up at 8.8. So, I mean, that might come up a little bit, but I guess, you know, with the way that you're talking about the post-Rudolph plan, it might not jump as high as the Smith optimists would hope.
Right, so I get some lingering optimism with Smith. Like he's fine as a pass catcher. It's the snap count that you got to worry about. I don't know if we see a great reason to believe the snap count goes higher. I think more likely than Smith, if there's going to be kind of like a third pass catcher who's really useful in fantasy this year, I think it's actually going to be Amir Smith Marset, the fifth round pick from Iowa, who, funny enough, reminds me a lot of Stephon Diggs. And I know he's not quite as athletic as Diggs. He's certainly a little skinnier. I think Smith Marset is actually faster than he ran at the pro day. But I still believe it. I just think that guy's fast as hell. And if you watch him play at Iowa, there were a bunch of plays, too, where he just has no doubt just victories at the line of scrimmage in a way that you just don't really see that often. There are so many plays where he doesn't struggle to just decisively lose the corner. And on a lot of them, the Iowa quarterback immediately proceeds to just kind of like shank punt the ball to the other side of the field. And he has to like stop on what would have been an 80-yard touchdown and come back to catch like a 7-yard pass where he gets just destroyed in the middle of the field by three different defenders. So that's what life was like when he was playing in the offense. But when you look at that Iowa offense and those games that he played there the last 2 years, they completed 58.4% of their passes at 7 yards per attempt. Amir Smith Marset caught 59%. So you can call that baseline, but it's, you know, 0.6 higher catch percentage than the team baseline, if we're being precise. And then 7 yards per attempt as a team compared to 9.1 yards per target for Smith Marset. He was doing that with over 24% share of the yardage there. So I know some people are on Smith Marset. A lot of people kind of just start, I think, look at the draft capital and are like, oh, he's a fifth round pick. He's not going to do anything. He's just a backup. And they look at his receiving volume at Iowa, and it's not that high. But when you look at how bad the Iowa passing game was, he took a pretty big share of it. It's just easy to miss it. And B, he was so far above the baseline that, in my opinion, there's no doubt he has skill that most receivers don't. It's not easy to outplay a baseline by 2 yards when you're keeping up with a baseline of catch percentage. So I think Smith Marset's going to displace Chad Beebe and maybe Irv Smith even on some of the slot snaps. And another understated potential upside avenue with Smith Marset is the fact that Thielen is getting a bit older and he's gotten hurt each of the last 2 years. I think Thielen is very good. But if he gets hurt, they got to go to Smith Marset. I mean, BC Johnson's still there. I guess I shouldn't totally forget about him. He's better than BB too. But Smith Marset is a much better prospect than BC Johnson was. And I think once they get him out there, it's going to be hard to put him back on the sideline because he's just so obviously explosive.
Okay. All right. So we might actually have a useful wide receiver 3 in Minnesota. And again, you know, maybe we do see Thielen, his target count come back down a little bit. If you know, Smith Marset is able to force the issue that way. I want to round it out with some Dalvin Cook discussion. So we know that he is coming off that career year. Of course, he was a total league winner for pretty much anyone last year. Goes out 312 carries. The only guy with more carries, of course, being Derrick Henry, and 40 more carries than Josh Jacobs almost as the number three guy. So we don't really think of Cook as the workhorse guy, and we didn't really have reason to because he had gotten hurt during his time at Florida State in those first 2 years in the league. But he's been healthy these last couple of years. But is he one of those guys where you do kind of have an injury red flag, even though he, you know, is coming off such a big season? And, you know, maybe compare that to like a Saquon Barkley, who is quantifiably coming off of a big injury.
Yeah, I'd say it's more like a yellow flag kind of thing, because there is a valid risk, like a concern, I should say. The risk is real. There's no doubt about it. Dalvin Cook has a shoulder that's a bit of a problem. I think it was separated at one point, and that's, I think he might have separated it more than once, actually, and that's the whole problem. When you have that happen to a shoulder, it's just never the way it was before, and it gets the same injury more easily from then. I don't think there's much reason to think that, like, the knee is a lingering concern, but he might kind of be at a little bit higher risk than some guys of just kind of, like, muscle injuries, because he's just so, like, just freakishly explosive. And again, like, that 1 year at Florida State, he played with a bad hamstring, like, every game, just, like, leave at halftime every game and still somehow had, like, 1,700 yards.
Yeah, so, he'd come off the field, get rolled out, and go. Yeah.
Yeah, maybe he's a guy who, even when he gets hurt, he often can just kind of play through it, and it's not a huge deal. Who really knows? But with a guy like him, especially when you know he can win your league for you in the event that he has decent injury luck, I don't know practically what you can do other than maybe limit your exposure. And if you're on the clock for the second overall pick and you're only doing one league this year, I don't see a way you can pass on Cook. If you're doing 10 leagues in that second spot, maybe you do want to take, somebody else one of those times. Ideally, you would just kind of get a fifth and sixth pick the next times and just be able to take players at ADP to reduce your exposure rather than specifically swerve out of the way. But yeah, if you can't really, in my opinion anyway, just be like, oh, well, Dalvin's due for an injury, so I'm going to go with this other guy. Like, he might be, maybe he is doomed to a certain number of injuries, but we don't have any better reason to think it's this year than next, you know? And what are you going to do, fade
right,
both and, years until he gets hurt again?
Right, and we've seen in the past where, you know, the people that were concerned about the injury with him have gotten completely burned each of the last 2 years.
Yeah, it's just, it can happen to any player, and especially any running back. Saquon Barkley coming back from the ACL is more concerning to me than Dalvin's cumulative injury history. But I just don't really know what you can do other than just, take that plunge and just know that you really couldn't have done more about it.
So then, is Mike Boone kind of one of your favorite, I guess handcuff isn't the right word necessarily, but like,
lottery
just kind of, yeah, lottery ticket, backup target type of guys.
I haven't gotten any shares yet.
Alexander Madison.
Madison, definitely. Yeah. He's a weird one too. Like, I don't know why anyone feels so burned by it. They don't feel burned by like Tony Pollard last year, but because Dalvin Cook didn't get hurt, it's like the people who got Madison last year are swearing off of him this year. And even though he's worth the exact same projection as he was a year ago, he's going, I want to say, something like two rounds later. So to me, it's kind of a very different part of the draft, very different player situation, but it's kind of like the David Montgomery last year or the Josh Jacobs this year. It's like everybody hates this guy now, and they're not really looking clearly at the details. The actual details are kind of getting lost, and you don't really need to be a truther to see why. It's like, oh yeah, of course he is easily worth this price. He should probably go a round or two earlier because Dalvin Cook's got, bad injury history. It's not great. And that shoulder especially is something that can go wrong pretty easily.
No, absolutely. And didn't mean to throw you off by the Mike Boone drop. I guess I get my Minnesota so cool. backup How running backs. And we talked about him earlier.
I struggle to talk about it. Yeah, he's awesome. If they cut Gordon or say they're going to cut Gordon while we're here, I'll be interested in Boone in the 20th or whatever.
There we have it. All right, that's going to wrap things up for this week's edition of the RotoWire NFL podcast brought to you by our friends over at WinBet. We'll be back next week. Thanks for listening.
Try RotoWire today, free for 10 days. Get our premium tools, rankings, analysis, and breaking news alerts. No credit card required. Go to rotowire.com/try.